This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. There's English and philosophy, there's psych and physics too, there's chemistry and history, and even more, it's true that college isn't only books and learning. There is more, the glee club and the theater groups. Some lectures are a bore, but some are great, and then there's demonstrations on the green. You say that I've forgotten something? What is it you mean?
Football! You idiot!
Oh yeah, football. Joining me now on the line to herald the harvest time hijinks of the hashmark heavyweights of the wink-wink amateur variety is Yahoo Sports national columnist Dan Wetzel. Dan, welcome back to Only a Game.
Bill, don't be so excited about college football.
Hell, that's what you're here for, my friend.
I don't know what you mean, wink-wink amateur. Are you suggesting that, there's rules being bent in the glorious NC2A?
Me? Suggest? No. Now, there are currently five undefeated Division I-A college football teams. Which, if any, of that quintet is likely to make it to the end of the season with an unblemished record?
I think there's going to be two that have the best route. One is Texas. They are number two in the polls, but they have the easiest schedule to go. They play three pretty weak teams, and then they would match up with Colorado, who they already beat by 25 points. So I think Texas would be a monumental upset for them to go down, and I think Southern California will continue to run the table. They have three games against ranked teams, but they should beat all three of them. And the final game would be a huge matchup in Los Angeles against what could be unbeaten UCLA. Obviously a huge crosstown game, but I think SC is much better. So I think I would go with those two would be the favorites to run the table.
The unnameable entity, which represents itself with a three-letter encryption, has been tweaked for 5 years now. Will that result in a bowl season that delights all, or does the fact that four teams may be considered worthy of the Rose Bowl championship game further rile the letter after A, letter after B, letter after R gang?
No, I think we'll have a controversy. I think there'll be probably three unbeaten teams at least. And the controversy will focus on the University of Texas. Texas finishes undefeated. They will still probably make the Rose Bowl in the title game, even though they will have played a very weak schedule. They can make it to the final game without beating a team that beat a single-ranked team, if that makes sense. And very little does in this. But the BCS was tweaked again last year.
Oh, there it is.
Every time I fall for it.
Either that or you're just a slow learner. I don't know.
That's true. You know, it's all about college football. You got to go slow here.
That's right. In any case, you were saying?
They tweaked it so that the human polls would have a greater weight in the formula to determine how you take four undefeated teams and choose two that are the best. Mm-hmm. Texas has the human vote. But a lot of that may not be worthwhile because their schedule is so considerably weaker than the other undefeated teams. So it's in many ways a popularity contest once again, and I would think they will tweak the formula for a sixth consecutive year.
Dan, in case it hasn't become evident already, I have to acknowledge my interest in the bowl season, such as that interest was, is diminished because there is no longer a humanitarian bowl. What became of it?
Well, the humanitarian bowl never really recovered from the fact that they once had a vicious bench-clearing brawl during it, which was not very humanitarian, of course. The bowl does exist. It's now the MPC Computer Bowl.
That doesn't exactly trip off the tongue.
No, that doesn't. Not many of these do, but because really, clearly selling MPC computers is far more important to the human world than having a humanitarian bowl, reminding us all to be humanitarians.
Well, I think my new favorite has to be the Poinsettia Bowl presented by San Diego County Credit Union, but that doesn't really roll off the tongue either.
No, that's not pretty good. My favorite was the former Mazda Tangerine Bowl, because when I think fresh citrus, I think Japanese auto company.
Yeah, a kind of tangerine-colored Mazda. Yeah. Have something going for it. On the other hand, poinsettias are nice. Do you like poinsettias?
Oh, yeah, everyone likes the poinsettia. Poinsettia is like the old-school gift certificate around Christmas, except only better, because it really you can give it to people you have no idea what to get, like your Aunt Lucy or, you know, the neighbor down the street. And it makes you look like a very thoughtful individual, even though you really aren't thoughtful. You're just buying the same gift for everybody.
This is making me wonder how long before we get the fruitcake bowl.
See, the fruitcake is the old school poinsettia, and it's got just got cheesy. But points, I mean, anyone who makes Christmas shopping easy, you give someone a poinsettia, they're usually quite happy.
Yeah. Penn State would appear to be eminently bowl-bound at this point. They're a very healthy 8-1. What magic elixir has Joe Paterno found?
Well, they hit the recruiting trail last year, and they got four freshman wideouts who can really play. Derek Williams, Justin King, Jordan Norwood, and Dion Butler, all young kids, and in maybe un-Paterno fashion, he decided to play them all. He's more of a let's-play-the-seniors guy traditionally, but at 79, next month, no time like the present for Joe Paterno. So they played them all. These kids are great. They have a senior quarterback, and that's really the difference. They're a lot more talented. It's always about the players, not the coach. The top coaches are all about even. You got to have players.
Is there anything to be made of the fact that Notre Dame head coach Charlie Weiss was offered a 10-year, $40 million contract, which he accepted this week after guiding his team to a 5-2 record, but no similar arrangement was made for Tyrone Willingham in 2002 after he had led the Irish to a 10-2 record?
Well, I think race obviously is something that gets questioned on that because Willingham is black and Charlie Weiss is white. And I think maybe there's something there. However, I really feel it's more Charlie Weiss knowing how to play the business of football better than Tyrone Willingham, who's a lot more of a not so savvy of a businessman. Charlie Weiss comes from the NFL. He learned under Bill Parcells and Bill Belichick. He knows how to get contract extensions. He did that by floating rumors in the newspapers that the NFL wanted to hire him. Some team was going to come after him, and Notre Dame responded accordingly. Tyrone Willingham never did anything like that, and Notre Dame did not respond accordingly. I don't think after seven games they could have been – I covered that team a lot, that Notre Dame-Tyrone Willingham team. Notre Dame alums, administrators, fans could not have been happier with a coach than they were after those seven or eight games when Willingham won them all. I mean, they were ecstatic, and if he had played that game, he could have gotten a long extension also. He just didn't. Weiss just really played the business part perfectly. It's a little savage. It's a little duplicit, but he's got $40 million coming.
Which of today's games bear watching?
Well, the one that matters most is Miami, Florida at Virginia Tech. Va Tech has to win to keep its undefeated season, its national championship alive. And if you're more of a fan of pro football than college football, Virginia Tech features Marcus Vick, the younger brother of Michael Vick, who also is a big star at Virginia Tech. They play very similarly. So it should be a fast-paced, high-exciting game, and there's a lot on the line.
Dan Wetzel is a national columnist for Yahoo Sports, and he shares his gridiron knowledge with Only a Game from time to time. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, Bill.
On Wednesday, the New York Knicks tipped off their 2005-2006 season at Boston's TD Bank North Garden against the Celtics. The team hopes to improve upon last year's 33-49 regular season record and find its way back into the NBA playoffs with the help of a new old head coach and an oft-criticized general manager. Only a Game's Gabe O'Connor reports.
On opening night, everyone's hopeful, even the New York Knicks. Before Wednesday's game at Boston's TD Bank North Garden, guard Stephon Marbury was positively bubbling.
I'm not talking about the past. What happened last year is what happened last year.
Okay, so bubbling was not the right word. That's understandable, as the Knicks' starting point guard, the difficult task of avoiding a fifth straight losing season falls largely on him. But the Knicks are going into the season with a very different roster, and Knick fans can thank team president Isaiah Thomas for that. Center Eddie Curry, forward Quentin Richardson, and rookie guard Nate Robinson were just three of the eight new players acquired by Thomas in the offseason. After 2 years on the job, some wonder if Thomas has a concrete plan. Mitch Lawrence covers the NBA for the New York Daily News.
He has never told anyone what his plan is. The only plan we know of about Isaiah is that he's willing to take chances on just about anybody, and that includes Eddie Curry. the Bulls player who had heart problems last year. Isaiah's just ready to roll the dice and make moves. He's probably trying to make a trade right now.
For years, the Knicks had taken on players that no other team would touch because of injuries or bloated contracts. Thomas says the team was built around All-Star guard Stephon Marbury and Allen Houston, but when Houston was slow to recover from a knee injury that eventually forced him to retire, Thomas felt he needed to go in another direction and tore the team apart. With a revamped roster, Thomas says he stopped making moves, for now.
I like what we have. It's just a matter now of letting our young players play and letting the team season a little bit and, try to carve out some turf in the NBA.
Helping the young players season is the league's oldest coach, Larry Brown. The nomadic Brown has successfully carved out turf for many NBA teams, most recently in Detroit, where he led the Pistons to the title in 2003. Thomas, who won two titles himself with the Pistons in 1989 and 1990, hopes his new coach can bring a winning attitude to the Knicks. But Brown is notoriously stubborn and has a very clear idea of how a team should be run. That may spell trouble for as long as he's in New York, says Mitch Lawrence.
He has a very anti-Larry Brown type of team. He has a team that is nothing like the Pistons. He likes to have defensive-minded, rebounding teams that share the ball. And he's got the total opposite. He's got a weak defensive team, they don't rebound well, and they're me-first offensive players.
But despite the team's reputation, Brown says he likes what he's seen so far, especially from the rookies.
I thought Isaiah did a great job in the draft with the three kids we got. And then Jackie Butler, and then you look at Trevor and Jamal and Eddie and Quentin. We're young, from top to bottom, and they all have a chance to improve.
And the players have bought into the Larry Brown way of basketball, says Nate Robinson.
You got to. He's a coach. He knows what he wants. So by me being a player, I'm just trying to learn as much as I possibly can, so I'm along for the ride.
The Knicks eventually lost Wednesday's game in overtime. Larry Brown looked on helplessly as his team gave the game away with sloppy ball handling, poor rebounding, and awful free throw shooting. With patience and time, things could turn around. But patience is a lot to ask from a coach like Larry Brown, and a city like New York. For Only a Game, I'm Gabe O'Connor in Boston.
We are New York, and we love basketball. We're gonna take it off.
It's 19 minutes past. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, a conversation with downhiller Bodie Miller. But first, for a lot of Americans, running 26.2 miles might seem like cruel and unusual punishment. But for a small group of inmates at the Charles Bass Correctional Complex in Nashville, Tennessee, distance running offers freedom. In fall and spring, prisoners can run side by side with free worlders, volunteers from a Nashville runners club called the Nashville Striders. This September, Striders and inmates ran a 5K race, a half marathon, and a full marathon inside the prison yard at an event they call the Jaunt in the Joint. Reporter Kim Green was there, and she has this report.
It's a perfectly normal pre-race night pasta dinner in most respects. Runners slurp down mounds of spaghetti and share racing stories. Except most of these competitors are wearing prison blues.
Okay, how many of you here run so you can have this dinner twice a year?
No.
Nope? Is that because of that? Because this is better than what you usually get, is that right?
In a dreary institutional gymnasium, three young inmates share a folding table with a petite runner named Margie. In running, at least, they find common ground.
It's for the environment, the people, the fitness.
The health.
Competing against yourself and meeting your own goals in life.
I guess you learn patience.
Yes.
You can't survive if you don't have patience. And I guess in running, takes patience and
Understanding and acceptance. And
right.
A lot of them.
Where'd you read that?
It just kind of came to me. That's cool.
Yeah.
Prisoners turn out for this event for all sorts of reasons. Some out of curiosity. A chance to get to know someone from the outside. Many, just to try something new and get a little exercise. But for a few dedicated inmates, running has become a vital part of their lives.
In the penitentiary, it's hard to do things that you feel good about.
Craig Nunn started training regularly more than 6 years ago when he first landed behind bars. A former trauma surgeon, he's Doc Nunn to the guys here, and pretty much the ringleader of all things running related at Charles Bass. He organized the first marathon here 4 years ago, then invited the Nashville Striders to help with the event the following year. He says distance running gives him a sense of accomplishment and a much-needed feeling of solitude in a place where such things are scarce.
There's a lot of negative energy around here, and to be able to focus on a goal and then train for that over a period of months or even years and eventually reach it gives a feeling of satisfaction that's not usually available in the prison system. And I think in that respect, it's unique.
Runners, to your mark, go!
Three groups of inmates and striders set off around the perimeter of the prison ball field. Each lap is approximately one-third of a mile. One group is doing a 5K heat, while another makes the first of 39 circuits in a half marathon. 10 hardy souls actually plan to run the full marathon on this steamy late summer morning. That's 78 tedious laps. The good news is, you can't get off course. Just keep the barbed wire on your right. Each runner has an inmate or free world volunteer timekeeper who keeps track of laps and serves as a personal cheering section.
Looking good! Meredith! Impressing me!
Nashville Striders president Peter Pressman, who's running in a later heat, says he and the other Striders don't mind running around in circles. They're here to support the inmates' initiative.
You can see the increase, the enthusiasm, the commitment that they've made, some of the weight loss that I've seen. I've been told by the warden there's been a number of people that have stopped smoking. They've had requests for some diet considerations and changes in the kitchen to kind of accommodate this new lifestyle.
I feel better about myself. I feel better.
Van Spink says he's lost 100 pounds since he started running last year. But for him, the rewards of training for even just a 5K race extend well beyond health.
I was only able to do one lap again with running, and I encouraged myself, I kept going. I wanted to finish. I wanted to do something, complete something. I feel fantastic. I've completed something at this point. So it's maybe a small step, but it's something.
Many of the runner inmates I talk to say the same thing, that until they finished a race, they never thought they could set a goal and achieve it. Many of them hope that new skill can propel them over bigger hurdles. For Vance Spinks, that means a correspondence degree in computer science. And for 60-year-old Paul Carnell, who came from another prison to run here today, it's a gateway to an exciting, if mysterious, life beyond the walls.
I've been running at River Bend and running down at Charles Bass Corrections Facility, you know, and just run till I get to that door to freedom. And I'm going to run in the marathon. I'm going to get out and get my checkup with my doctor. And if he tell me I can do it, I'm going to run in the marathon at the Music City Marathon, and I'm going to take it from there and go on up and around in Boston and New York up there.
For Carnell and other inmates, running provides a link to freedom that borders on the spiritual. Many say its meditative quality allows them to better cope with the frustrations of prison life. They mention self-determination and will, or even the simple feeling of having something all their own that no guard can take away, a powerful intangible that they've worked hard for and won.
Nice and easy, Sana, nice and easy.
Tyree Cheney is a former inmate at the Charles Bass Correctional Complex. Tall and supremely fit, running has remained an important part of his life outside. It's obvious the inmates respect him. He's gotten out and landed a real job, something they all hope to do. Cheney's now a supervisor at TEMA, a local disaster relief agency. He's here today to run a half marathon, and because he remembers what it felt like to live here.
A lot of guys here, their families forget about them, friends forget about them. It's like, you know, sometimes they feel like, you know, they just at the end of their rope. So it's kind of personal to me, and it's very important that the guys that are worthy of it, and they will be out back in society again, some of them will. And the thing is, the ones that will be, show them that it's a better way than this.
For some participants, the most important thing about the John in the Joint is that they get a glimpse of the outside world by getting to know the Striders. Inmate Orson Hudson says the event makes him feel like some people on the outside do actually care about them.
It's kind of putting us back in society almost, you know. We kind of comfort, you know what I'm saying, both sides, you know, free will and inmates, you know what I'm saying, that we get together, you know what I'm saying, and just be as one, you know. It's not that we think now that we free will and inmates, we're just friends right now, you know. It's just having a best friend that you never knew, you know.
Several of the Striders stay in touch with inmates throughout the year. They talk about training ups and downs and donate running shoes to replace worn prison-issue sneakers. But nobody ever seems to talk about the crimes that landed inmates here in the first place. It's taboo to ask, and no one wants to damage this fragile truce that, for a day at least, transcends all the barbed wire and concrete. Instead, both striders and stripers prefer to focus on commonalities, saying, today, we all wear the same numbers, racing numbers. For Only a Game, I'm Kim Green in Nashville.
In a new as-told-to autobiography, ski champion Bodie Miller writes, life for me is one long seek-and-enjoy mission. Certainly Miller's public persona has borne out that credo. He's been known as much for thumbing his nose at traditional methods of training as he has been for winning Olympic medals and World Cup races. The title of his book is Bodie, Go Fast, Be Good, Have Fun. But Miller has always been a more complex character than that injunction suggests. In the prologue, he contends that the book is necessary in part because of, quote, media coverage that has consistently missed the mark. He also says that he won't read the book. Bodie Miller joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Bodie, welcome to Only a Game.
Yeah, thank you.
You and your collaborator, Jack McEnany, write, quote, I love the gestalt of skiing, the integration of biology, technology, and psychology to excel at something that's over long before you can soft-boil an egg. And a few pages later, you speculate about achieving the ultimate platonic ski race. Is that sort of language a response to those who've described you as a beer-loving, rebellious jock?
Absolutely not. I mean, I think I'm not afraid to bust out my 20-point words here and there, but for the most part, I like to try to make things as simple as possible, and I think that's one area where I appreciate his input in the book. I think he adds a little bit of, you know, the flamboyant side to a lot of my stories that are really pretty basic and simple. I mean, I basically like to try to simplify everything to make it the most accessible, and I think that sometimes, you know, especially when you're writing or when you're telling a long story, sometimes that can get a little boring.
Platonic, in the context you've used it, is fine, of course, but how important has winning been to the enjoyment that you describe throughout the book?
It's a tough question. I mean, the winning itself, I don't think is very important at all, but, you know, the implications of winning are important. You know, if you don't win, you don't stay on the ski team and you don't, you know, you have obviously financial obligations. You can't, have, you know, the financial freedom and all that stuff. So, you know, the implications of winning are important for the enjoyment in the rest of my life. But for the most part, the wins or the times when I've won haven't been the times that I've enjoyed the most, or the, you know, what I would consider my biggest successes. A lot of times it's as subtle as your approach or your ability to overcome some obstacle that is simply in your mind. I mean, we all know that sometimes those are the hardest ones to overcome. You know, if you have a physical obstacle in front of you, all you do is, you know, sort out your tactics, figure out the logistics and attack it. In your mind, sometimes it's a lot more subtle. And especially when you're dealing with the pressures or the time frame of a World Cup race, you know, achieving those or overcoming those can be really a huge thrill when you start to realize that you're doing stuff that, you know, potentially no one else in the world could even think about doing, and for sure they have no chance of recognizing.
Because of the enormous amount of time that you had spent skiing competitively in Europe, you brought a different attitude to the 2002 Olympics than most American athletes did. How did that color the way you viewed the political overtones of those Olympics?
Yeah, I mean, it's painful, really. For me to go to an Olympics in my home country, in a crazy state like Utah, and have all these people putting words in my mouth or really just assimilating me with the Olympic message that, you know, not the Olympic oath. If that was the case, I'd be, you know, fired up. I think the Olympic oath is one of the last bastions of purity in sports. I mean, I think that, you know, it's all about the struggle. It's not about victory. As you know, life is about the same thing. And when you go to the Olympics these days, it's all about the medals. If you don't have a chance at a gold medal, or if you're not on the podium, it's like they everyone's like, why did you even go? Why bother? And it's that undertone in sports right now is one of the most frustrating things for me. It's just too many people these days are not either they don't recognize it or they're not willing to stand up and say that that's just wrong. I mean, it's totally unacceptable, essentially, in society for somebody to say, I don't really care about winning. I care about performing at my top level. And if my top level stinks and that's what I got to do, that's what I got to do. And that's what makes me happy. And, you know, it's kind of a catch 22 because it's easy for a winner, somebody who wins all the time, to say it's not all about winning. And when somebody who loses all the time says it's not all about winning, they just say that's what losers say.
Throughout most of the book, you sound as if you feel as if you're a very fortunate guy, but at one point you seem to be worrying that you've been skiing competitively perhaps for too long. To be precise, you write, quote, 8 years of essentially the same thing. How long could this go on? What's the answer to that question?
Yeah, I mean, you got to search for your motivation. You know, there's a part of me that wants to do it because I still find an athletic challenge in ski racing. And there's a part of me at this point that's simply doing it because I have a unique opportunity to make an impact on the sporting world. And I've, you know, the value of sports to me is huge. It's been a huge part of my life, and I want to see it healed because right now it's in a pretty sick state in my mind. And that was a conundrum that lasted all summer. And it was really a tough thing because I have a serious problem with going to the Olympics if I'm not really into it, if I'm not 100% motivated, if I'm not buying into it with all my, you know, my soul or whatever you want to call it. And that's tough because I have a huge engine, a huge motor behind me right now pushing me to go there, whether I want to or not, because they have all this money invested, you know, my sponsors, all this stuff. So a part of me was rebelling against that pressure to do something that I didn't really believe in necessarily. And it was, you know, for me, this time through is a lot different than the last two times for me.
You have been in the news recently for some of your opinions regarding the current rules and regulations for dope testing. Tell me a little bit about what you think is wrong with the current system.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is something wrong with the current system, and the system is not effective, and it's not willing to accept change, and it's really operating with its own agenda as opposed to for the betterment of the sport or with the athlete's safety in mind. And right now it's such a taboo issue to bring up that as soon as any athlete, especially myself, as soon as I even bring it up at all, you know, the media latches on to the opposite basically of what I'm saying. I mean, I've heard it said that, you know, I want to liberalize drug testing and I want to blah, blah, blah. And the fact is I did grow up in a hippie sort of environment. So I think they're kind of attaching the two, but the fact is I want it all much more regulated. I want the drugs that are even the legal ones like creatine, things like that. I want those at least regulated to a limit and just allow that limit to be set by the safety factor for athletes. I think that right now there's some stuff that's on the banned substance list that is not unhealthy for an athlete. And then there's other stuff that's not on the banned substance list that is, especially with no regulations on it at all, like creatine, for instance, that somebody can eat 10 pounds of it a day, and it's clearly a performance-enhancing drug. There's no regulation on it at all. I just don't think that makes any sense.
Then there's also the inconvenience of them chasing you down when you're not skiing or in training for skiing. You have to tell them where you are all the time so they can supposedly find you.
Right, right. And that, I mean, I just missed a test the other day, which is going to be pretty funny, I think. I mean, it's the perfect time with all my comments and how stressed everyone is and with the Olympics. And I decided to drive down to New York that night instead of the next day. And on my sheet that I filled out 3 months ago, it said that I would be home for another 16 hours than I was. And they showed up within that 16-hour period, and I was already down here. And so I missed a test, and that's, you know, if I miss two more in the next 16 months or 18 months or something, then I'm automatically suspended from my sport for 2 years, which clearly I believe that I'm not cheating. I believe my ethics and my principles dictate that rather than the rules they set. But if I miss two more tests from inopportune schedule changes or things like that, I'm automatically suspended. So I think that's a good representation of, you know, being in a broken system.
I'm curious about what's next in terms of directions for you. You mention all sorts of possibilities in passing in the book. Maybe you'll be a tennis instructor next time we talk.
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, ideally, I would be able to disappear from the public eye as much as I can, because I think there's, if you're not making a positive impact or if you don't really have a message you believe in, I don't believe there's any reason to be in the public eye. And hopefully I'll be outside doing the stuff I love, you know, teaching tennis or playing golf or, you know, skiing and, you know, rock climbing, doing the stuff that I've wanted to do my whole life, that have sort of, you know, been constantly shoved down my priority line by, you know, silly things like doing interviews and making appearances for my sponsors and, you know, writing books.
Bodie Miller with Jack McEnany wrote Bodie, Go Fast, Be Good, Have Fun, published by Villard. Bodie Miller joined me from the NPR studios in New York. Bodie, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Absolutely. Thank you.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston. Additional support comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And from the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at CabotCheese.com.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, a buck naked Bonspiel you can hang on your wall for a whole year. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
We don't know whether the transient Saints, formerly of New Orleans, will beat the Chicago Bears in Baton Rouge tomorrow. We do know that if he's true to his word, the owner of the Saints, Tom Benson, will not attend the game. Why not?
Because he's nuts. That's why. He's a little bit upset with security. He's also a little upset with a cameraman who he attacked. And, you know, it's a bad thing to attack a cameraman. You know why, Bill?
It's
because they have a camera. That's why. And there was an email where he said he won't go there. He said, no person, much less the owner of an NFL team, should have either he, his family, or friends subjected to this form of danger, intimidation, and abuse. I was advised not to go, but wanted to support the league. This guy's going to go down in history very quickly as the worst owner in the history of the NFL.
In his recently published biography, longtime National Hockey League coach Jacques Demers acknowledges that he can't read or write. This is a pretty courageous admission, don't you think?
Yeah, and a very unusual one, and it's really there's really a lot of poignancy to it. Demers dropped out of eighth grade and never learned to read or write, and he got through it. I think the most poignant part of the story was he would always say he had forgotten his glasses.
Whenever anybody asked
right.
him to sign something.
I'd forgotten to read it, yeah, and good for him. And obviously there's more of this than I think even we know about now. And, I mean, between him bringing this struggle to light and Teddy Bruschi coming back after a stroke, it's been a good year for public service ads.
I have to wonder if the folks at the five teams that employed Demers as a coach and a general manager, or both, are now wondering how he so successfully hid the fact that he was illiterate.
Because he apparently knows a lot about hockey. I'm just glad the owners didn't know about his problem when they would hand him his contract.
Meanwhile, the National Hockey League set an attendance record during October. Charlie, did all those folks who said that they would never come back after the lost season change their minds on the same night?
They're all back. They're back for now. Let's see what it's like in February and March. The new play is certainly more fan-friendly. The NHL is going out of its way to apologize for having immolated itself. We'll see if this thing has legs, but it's an encouraging sign.
Pavel Bure announced his retirement from the NHL this week, and he wasn't unemployed for very long. He's the new general manager of Russia's Olympic hockey team. I wonder if he's going to be the first player/general manager.
He says no. He's going to be general manager, and not only that, the Russians are going to be happy. He says no grouchy players on the team. Huh. Anybody who plays for the team wants to be there.
The Boston Red Sox reclaimed the title for team most dramatically shooting itself in the foot when their general manager quit. Some of the dust has settled since Monday. Why did Theo Epstein walk away, in a gorilla suit, no less, from what allegedly was his dream job not all that long ago?
First of all, he wasted his money on the gorilla suit because, as you know, Theo Epstein has a twin brother. Why didn't he just use the twin brother? Why did he go to the expense of wasting money on the gorilla suit? I think that's something we have to examine about his management style. Look, Theo, Larry, John Henry, Kurt Schilling, The Globe, The Herald, Nesson, Jake, it's Chinatown! I'm willing to ascribe completely to the notion that he wants to take some time off. Because otherwise, it doesn't make any sense. If they really did offer him $4.5 million to keep a job he says he loves to do, and he turned it down because of a couple of newspaper columns, then he should grow up. I don't believe that's the reason. I think he's taken a couple of years off. I think his deteriorating relationship with Larry Lucchino and the rest of Red Sox management has something to do with his wanting to take a year off. If he wants to backpack around Europe, he's already been to the playoffs three times and won one World Series as a general manager. If he wants to ride his motorcycle around Europe for a year and come back and become the general manager of the Washington Nationals, God love him. Let him do it.
Nice timing, though, with the general manager's meetings coming up.
Yeah, but you know what?
Mere hours from now.
Had the general manager's meeting ever been on your radar before? Suddenly, this is the Council of Trent. I never heard of this operation before.
Years ago, you wrote an article about some thieves who stole the souvenirs of baseball legend Cool Papa Bell, who played for years in the Negro Leagues, a dominant pitcher, and it was a very sad story. But I think this week's sports-related robbery may have it beat. You be the judge.
Yeah, in Temple City, California, a thief walked off with a 16-year-old softball player's prosthetic leg. It cost like $5,000 to $7,000, and it can't be used for anyone because it's custom-made. You can't sell it on the street. It was taken by somebody who actually broke into the young lady's house and stole it and also took $1,500 worth of fundraising certificates and some video games. It's really a sad tale, and it does... to those of us who are fans of the late great Flannery O'Connor, does recall the short story she wrote about a guy who went around stealing this.
Arguably the most literary reference on Only a Game for at least the past 6 months.
But I'm sure
nicely done.
I'm sure someone will step up and replace the leg.
Joe Paterno, head coach of the bowl-bound 8-1 Nittany Lions, rushed to the aid of Air Force coach Fisher DeBerry this week, just in time too. Yes.
Yeah, he's trying to bail Fisher DeBerry out, who, as we've mentioned previously, I think, was on double-secret probation on saying stupid stuff for having said more stupid stuff. Joe said that Afro-American kids can run very well. That doesn't mean Caucasian kids and other descents can't run, but it's very obvious to me that they run extremely well. Guys, put down the shovels. Stop digging. Climb out of the hole with the ladder.
Finally, Charlie Betters, wishing to obtain can't-miss predictions of Virginia Tech football games, now have an invaluable resource named Shanna. Are you familiar with this?
Yes, and I'm more than that familiar with Shanna. I'm familiar with Shanna's tongue, which is vital to this whole enterprise. And
I don't like where this is headed
at
all.
Let me explain this to you. Shane Brannick, the barn manager of the agriculture school at Virginia Tech, he says that Shanna can pick the scores of the game and that her first prediction was that the Hokies would beat Ohio University 47-3, and Tech won the game 45-0, which is fairly close. Shanna predicted that Virginia Tech would beat Boston College 27-10. They did, in fact, beat Boston College 30-10, so Shanna's right there. Mm-hmm. After Shanna's game day morning meal, Brannick says, this is the cow whisperer, Mr. Brannick, she licks his left hand once for every point the Hokies' opposition will score, and his right hand once for every point the Hokies will score.
Hey, this Wilbur, what's all this talking animal stuff?
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Hey, Bill, you want to know the Bruins score?
In the Only a Game newsletter last week, I suggested several reasons for the dip in television ratings during this year's World Series. The explanation endorsed by the greatest number of respondents was that the games started too late and went too long. Respondents from Columbia, Missouri to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania admitted that they couldn't stay up late enough to see the late innings. But Steve Fink, who lives in Arizona, and Don Gemmer, who lives in Minneapolis, maintained that people didn't watch because the games were on Fox. Mr. Gemmer wrote, "Announcers Buck and McCarver made it practically unbearable." Of last week's Only a Game, Jay Pershing, who hears the program on WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts, wrote, "I can't believe it. 44 minutes into your show, you mentioned the passing of Wellington Mara. This guy devoted his life to the New York Giants, was a towering figure in the NFL, a devout Catholic and family man, and all you could do was casually mention his passing. No wonder you have to beg for money." Our story about the winless football team at Temple University reminded Temple alum Richard Andreoli, another WFCR listener, of a Saturday afternoon during his undergraduate days. Those of us in the dorm were rounded up, some said kidnapped, put on buses, and driven to the football field to see Temple play. They lost. The following year, after a tie, we rushed onto the field and tore down the goalposts. We didn't know if we'd ever get another chance. Thanks for bringing back those great memories. Liz Burke also emailed this week, I love NPR, she wrote, so it was a shock to hate a show so much. She went on to say she felt the story on Quidditch in last week's program deserved about 30 seconds, if that, and concluded, your show is usually so good, I listen with interest. There are so many great stories out there. Why this one? Well, Ms. Burke, let me explain. The National Geek Foundation, a longtime underwriter, stipulates that only a game feature a minimum of 2 hours of geek-friendly programming per annum. Karen Given is only up to about 94 minutes, and time is running out. You can register your opinion by visiting our website, onlyagame.org, and contacting us. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. Our mailing address is onlyagame, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It could have been a joke. In this age of internet hoaxes, we had our suspicions earlier this week when we received notice of a new calendar featuring nude and scantily clad female curlers. Adding to the intrigue, the photographer was, for 3 years, the skip of the women's curling team of Andorra, a 67,000-person principality wedged between France and Spain. As it turns out, the calendar, the country, and the photographer are all real. Anna Arthe joins me now on the line from her home in Andorra. Anna, welcome to Only a Game.
Hello, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. You're not the first to combine nudity and sports sponsorship. A few years ago, a friend brought me a copy of the Waltzing Matildas nude calendar, which raised money for Australia's national women's soccer team. What made you decide to create the Anna Arthe team sponsorship calendar?
Well, it's really, really simple. I've been playing curling for 8 years. My profession is photography. And then at the same time, and in my own team, because I play with a team, we always have problems for a sponsor and having money for training. Mm-hmm. So I said, why not doing the trying to help a little bit with the image of the sport and raising a little money? So it was quite simple as that. I mean, it's not a new idea, of course, but I thought maybe it would be something I could do.
Curling in the United States has a reputation for attracting older, less athletic enthusiasts. I don't mean to ask an indelicate question, but are there enough attractive female curlers to fill 12 months worth of calendar?
Oh, you cannot imagine how many they are. Sometimes they don't know they are pretty or beautiful, but it is my job and I can see that. So, yeah, no problem.
Well, you found 12 curlers from Canada, Denmark, England, Germany, Italy, Spain, and Poland willing to pose for the calendar. Was it difficult to convince the women to participate?
Not at all. At the beginning, I thought it was going to be more difficult than it was, but I just talked to them and explained, and many of them knew my work before, so it was very, very simple. I think mostly everybody I asked say yes, and they were very enthusiastic about the project.
Now, to my considerable regret, I don't have a copy of the calendar in front of me. Can you describe for me your favorite photo?
Well, it's quite difficult because everyone is special for me, but maybe Miss January, what is Poland? I think you had this picture because it had been on the newspapers. And I love that picture because it was very difficult to make. It was very early in the morning. I had an accident and I fell in a river and nearly drowned. So it's a
You nearly drowned?
Game. Yeah, because my equipment is very heavy, and we were outside in the country looking for a place to make the pictures, and I did a step too many, and I'm not very tall girl, so I was nearly on these dirty waters, and this girl was so fantastic and helping me, and we did the job, and 2 hours later we were doing a tournament in Latvia. I love this picture because of that, because all the story has behind all the difficulties and all the friendship, and I don't know, and I think she's beautiful, and she's a very, very nice girl.
She saved you from drowning, and then
yeah.
You took a beautiful picture of her.
Absolutely.
Well, that I am familiar with that picture. And yes. One of the things that strikes me about it is somebody looking at it is not going to think initially curling. It's a picture that was taken in the woods. There are trees. There's a meadow. There's no curling in evidence there.
It's not curling in any of the pictures. Mm-hmm. Because everybody was expecting something to do with curling, maybe a stone in the middle, hiding important places. And I thought I wanted to do it in a different way. So all the pictures are with nothing to do with curling.
The calendar will raise money for the teams of the 12 women who were photographed, and one hopes bring some attention to the sport as well. Certainly curling teams in the United States have trouble raising money and attracting notice. Do female curlers from other countries have that same problem attracting notice and sponsorship?
Yeah, absolutely. That's why the whole idea came about, because even the important countries like Scotland in Europe, they all have problems with money. The federation, they don't give enough money. And our dream is to go to North America to train. And that is very expensive for us.
The press release, which we received, contained the headline, Nude Athlete Calendar Shocks Curling World. But but the photos that I've seen are not shocking at all. They're very tasteful. Have people really been shocked?
I don't think they have been shocked. There is big expectation, of course, but... not shock or controversy, because, I mean, I know you haven't seen the pictures, but they are all, I hope, and I'm sure, very, very tasteful. So I think everybody can be proud, even the families, even the fathers and the mothers, the grandmothers, proud of these pictures. So I don't think anybody can be shocked when they see the pictures.
The calendar has certainly received attention. As you say, you've been delighted by that. I wonder if you're already planning the 2007 edition.
Well, yes, it's in my mind, because I have so many girls that I want to make pictures of them. Some of them are calling me already. So, yeah, and I promise you, there are many, many nice girls playing curling, young and beautiful, yes.
What about men? It would seem to me that the next step would be a men's curling calendar.
To tell you the truth, I would love, because it's much easier for me. Being a woman, it's much easier for me to see what is sexy or nice in a man. So I would love. The problem is, we think they will sell less than women. And I don't know what will happen with that.
Anna Arthay photographed the 12 athletes, including herself, who make up the Anna Arthay Team Sponsorship Calendar 2006. She joined me from her home in Andorra. Anna, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you. Thank you very much to you.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. Toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to browse Only a Game show archive or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from downhill skier and friend to the animals, Bodie Miller, who responds to my question regarding his pet donkey. Hadn't he been ill?
No, my ass feels great, thank you.
Well, that's probably because you give him plenty of hay and apples and you scratch behind his ears. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, from NPR member stations. From the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.